He flipped the page over, went on to the last one. It was a good paper, he knew, but it could not be published, not just yet. Perhaps after he had died. No one, so far as he could determine, had ever so much as realized the trend, had taken as matter of course the fact that men seldom left their homes. Why, after all, should they leave their homes? Certain dangers may be recognized in... The televisor muttered at his elbow, and he reached out to flip the toggle. The room faded, and he was face to face with a man who sat behind a desk, almost as if he sat on the opposite side of Webster's desk. A gray-haired man with sad eyes behind heavy lenses. For a moment, Webster stared, memory tugging at him. "Could it be?" he asked, and the man smiled gravely. "I have changed," he said. "So have you. My name is Claiborne, remember? The Martian Medical Commission."
"Claiborne, I'd often thought of you. You stayed on Mars."
Claiborne nodded. "I've read your book, Doctor. It is a real contribution. I've often thought one should be written. Wanted to myself, but I didn't have the time. Just as well I didn't. You did a better job. Especially on the brain."
"The Martian brain," Webster told him, "always intrigued me. Certain peculiarities. I'm afraid I spent more of those 5 years taking notes on it than I should have. There was other work to do."
"A good thing you did," said Claiborne. "That's why I'm calling you now. I have a patient. A brain operation. Only you can handle it."
Webster gasped, his hands trembling.
"You will bring him here?"
Claiborne shook his head.
"He cannot be moved. You know him, I believe. Duane, the philosopher."
"Duane," said Webster. "He's one of my best friends. We talked together just a couple of days ago."
"The attack was sudden," said Claiborne. "He's been asking for you."
Webster was silent and cold. Cold with a chill that crept upon him from some unguessed place. Cold that sent perspiration out upon his forehead, that knotted his fists.
"If you start immediately," said Claiborne, "you can be here on time. I've already arranged with the World Committee to have a ship at your disposal instantly. The utmost speed is necessary."
"But," said Webster, "but I cannot come."
"You can't come."
"It's impossible," said Webster. "I doubt, in any case, that I am needed. Surely you yourself..."
"I can't," said Claiborne. "No one can but you. No one else has the knowledge. You hold Juwayne's life in your hands. If you come, he lives. If you don't, he dies."
"I can't go into space," said Webster.
"Anyone can go into space," snapped Claiborne. "It's not like it used to be. Conditioning of any sort desired is available."
"But you don't understand," pleaded Webster. "You..."
"No, I don't," said Claiborne. "Frankly, I don't. That anyone should refuse to save the life of his friend."
The two men stared at one another for a long moment, neither speaking.
"I shall tell the committee to send the ship straight to your home," said Claiborne finally. "I hope by that time you will see your way clear to come."
Claiborne faded, and the wall came into view again. The wall and books, the fireplace and the paintings, the well-loved furniture, the promise of spring that came through the open window. Webster sat frozen in his chair, staring at the wall in front of him. Duane, the furry, wrinkled face, the sibilant whisper, the friendliness and understanding that was his. Duane, grasping the stuff that dreams are made of and shaping them into logic, into rules of life and conduct. Juwayn, using philosophy as a tool, as a science, as a stepping stone to better living. Webster dropped his face into his hands and fought the agony that welled up within him. Claiborne had not understood. One could not expect him to understand, since there was no way for him to know. And even knowing, would he understand? Even he, Webster, would not have understood it in someone else until he had discovered it in himself, the terrible fear of leaving his own fire, his own land, his own possessions, the little symbolisms that he had erected. And yet, not he, himself, alone, but those other Websters as well, starting with the first John Jay, men and women who had set up a cult of life, a tradition of behavior. He, Jerome A. Webster, had gone to Mars when he was a young man and had not felt or suspected the psychological poison that ran through his veins, even as Thomas a few months ago had gone to Mars. But 30 years of quiet life here in the retreat that the Websters called a home had brought it forth, had developed it without his even knowing it. There had, in fact, been no opportunity to know it. It was clear how it had developed, clear as crystal now. Habit and mental pattern and a happiness association with certain things, things that had no actual value in themselves, but had been assigned a value, a definite, concrete value by one family through 5 generations. No wonder other places seemed alien. No wonder other horizons held a hint of horror in their sweep. And there was nothing one could do about it. Nothing, that is, unless one cut down every tree and burned the house and changed the course of waterways. Even that might not do it. Even that. The televisor purred, and Webster lifted his head from his hands, reached out, and thumbed the tumbler. The room became a flare of white, but there was no image. A voice said, "Secret call, secret call." Webster slid back a panel in the machine, spun a pair of dials, heard the hum of power surge into a screen that blocked out the room. "Secrecy established," he said. The white flare snapped out, and a man sat across the desk from him. A man he had seen many times before in televised addresses, in his daily paper. Henderson, president of the World Committee. "I have had a call from Claiborne," said Henderson. Webster nodded without speaking. "He tells me you refuse to go to Mars."
"I have not refused," said Webster. When Claiborne cut off, the question was left open. I had told him it was impossible for me to go, but he had rejected that. Did not seem to understand.
"Webster, you must go," said Henderson. "You are the only man with the necessary knowledge of the Martian brain to perform this operation. If it were a simple operation, perhaps someone else could do it, but not one such as this."
"That may be true," said Webster.
"But it's not just a question of saving a life," said Henderson. "Even the life of so distinguished a personage as Juwayn, it involves even more than that. Juwayn is a friend of yours. Perhaps he hinted of something he has found."
"Yes," said Webster. "Yes, he did. A new concept of philosophy."
"A concept," declared Henderson, "that we cannot do without. A concept that will remake the solar system, that will put mankind ahead 100,000 years in the space of 2 generations. A new direction of purpose that will aim toward a goal we heretofore had not suspected, had not even known existed. A brand new truth, you see. One that never before had occurred to anyone."
Webster's hands gripped the edge of the desk until his knuckles stood out white.
"If Juwayn dies," said Henderson, "that concept dies with him, may be lost forever."
"I'll try."
said Webster. I'll try. Henderson's eyes were hard.
Is that the best you can do?
That is the best, said Webster.
But, man, you must have a reason, some explanation.
None, said Webster, that I would care to give. Deliberately, he reached out and flipped up the switch.
Webster sat at the desk and held his hands in front of him, staring at them. Hands that had skill, held knowledge. Hands that could save a life if he could get them to Mars. Hands that could save for the solar system, for mankind, for the Martians, an idea. A new idea that would advance them 100,000 years in the next 2 generations. But hands chained by a phobia that grew out of this quiet life. Decadence, a strangely beautiful and deadly decadence. Man had forsaken the teeming cities, the huddling places, 200 years ago. He had done with the old foes and the ancient fears that kept him around the common campfire, had left behind the hobgoblins that had walked with him from the caves. And yet, here was another huddling place. Not a huddling place for one's body, but one's mind. A psychological campfire that still held a man within the circle of its light. Still, Webster knew, he must leave that fire. As the men had done with the cities 2 centuries before, he must walk off and leave it. And he must not look back. He had to go to Mars, or at least start for Mars. There was no question there at all. He had to go. Whether he would survive the trip, whether he could perform the operation once he had arrived, he did not know. He wondered vaguely whether agoraphobia could be fatal. In its most exaggerated form, he supposed it could. He reached out a hand to ring, then hesitated. No use having Jenkins pack. He would do it himself. Something to keep him busy until the ship arrived. From the top shelf of the wardrobe in the bedroom, he took down a bag and saw that it was dusty. He blew on it, but the dust still clung. It had been there for too many years. As he packed, the room argued with him, talked in that mute tongue with which inanimate but familiar things may converse with a man. "You can't go," said the room. "You can't go off and leave me." And Webster argued back, half pleading, half explanatory. "I have to go. Can't you understand? It's a friend, an old friend. I will be coming back." Packing done, Webster returned to the study, slumped into his chair. He must go, and yet he couldn't go. But when the ship arrived, when the time had come, he knew that he would walk out of the house and toward the waiting ship. He steeled his mind to that, tried to set it in a rigid pattern, tried to blank out everything but the thought that he was leaving. Things in the room intruded on his brain, as if they were part of a conspiracy to keep him there. Things that he saw as if he were seeing them for the first time. Old, remembered things that suddenly were new. The chronometer that showed both Earthian and Martian time. The days of the month. The phases of the moon. The picture of his dead wife on the desk. The trophy he had won at prep school. The framed, short snorter bill that had cost him $10 on his trip to Mars. He stared at them, half unwilling at first, then eagerly, storing up the memory of them in his brain, seeing them as separate components of a room he had accepted all these years as a finished whole, never realizing what a multitude of things went to make it up. Dusk was falling, the dusk of early spring, a dusk that smelled of early pussy willows. The ship should have arrived long ago. He caught himself listening for it, even as he realized that he would not hear it. A ship, driven by atomic motors, was silent, except when it gathered speed, landing and taking off,
It floated like thistledown, with not a murmur in it. It would be here soon. It would have to be here soon, or he could never go. Much longer to wait, he knew, and his high-keyed resolution would crumble like a mound of dust in beating rain. Not much longer could he hold his purpose against the pleading of the room, against the flicker of the fire, against the murmur of the land where 5 generations of Websters had lived their lives and died. He shut his eyes and fought down the chill that crept across his body. He couldn't let it get him now, he told himself. He had to stick it out. When the ship arrived, he still must be able to get up and walk out the door to the waiting port. A tap came on the door.
Come in, Webster called.
It was Jenkins, the light from the fireplace flickering on his shining metal hide.
Had you called earlier, sir? He asked.
Webster shook his head.
I was afraid you might have, Jenkins explained,
and wondered why I didn't come. There was a most extraordinary occurrence, sir. 2 men came with a ship and said they wanted you to go to Mars.
They are here, said Webster. Why didn't you call me?
He struggled to his feet.
I didn't think, sir, said Jenkins, that you would want to be bothered. It was so preposterous. I finally made them understand you could not possibly want to go to Mars.
Webster stiffened, felt chill fear gripping at his heart. Hands groping for the edge of the desk, he sat down in the chair, sensed the walls of the room closing in about him, a trap that would never let him go.
Notes on the Third Tale. To the thousands of readers who love this tale, it is distinguished as the one in which the dogs first appear. To the student, it is much more than that. Basically, it is a tale of guilt and futility. Here, the breakdown of the human race continues, with man assaulted by a sense of guilt and plagued by the instability which results in the human mutants. The tale attempts to rationalize the mutations, attempts even to explain the dogs as modifications of the primordial strain. No race, the story says, can become improved if there are no mutations, but there is no word concerning the need of a certain static factor in society to ensure stability. Throughout the legend, it becomes abundantly clear that the human race placed little value upon stability. Tige, who has combed the legend to bolster his contention that the tales actually are human in their origin, believes that no doggish storyteller would have advanced the theory of mutation, a concept which runs counter to everything in the canine creed. A viewpoint such as this, he claims, must have sprung from some alien mind. Bounce, however, points out that throughout the legend, viewpoints which are diametrically opposed to canine logic often are presented in a favorable light. This, he says, is no more than the mark of a good storyteller, a twisting of values for a certain dramatic shock effect. That man is presented deliberately as a character who realizes his own shortcomings, there can be no doubt at all. In this tale, the human, Grant, talks about a groove of logic, and it is apparent that he senses something wrong with human logic. He tells Nathaniel that the human race is always worried. He fastens an almost infantile hope upon the Juwayne theory as something which might yet save the human race. And Grant, in the end, seeing the trend of destruction inherent in his race, passes the destiny of humanity on to Nathaniel. Of all the characters which appear in the legend, Nathaniel may be the only one having an actual historic basis. In other tales which have come from the racial past, the name Nathaniel is often mentioned. While it is patently impossible that Nathaniel could have accomplished all the deeds which are attributed to him in these tales, it is generally believed that he actually lived and was a figure of importance. The basis of that importance, of course, has been lost in the gulf of time.
The Webster family of humans, which was introduced in the first tale, continues to hold a prominent place throughout the rest of the legend. While this may be another piece of evidence to support Tighe's belief, it is possible that the Webster family once again may be no more than a mark of good storytelling, a device used to establish a link of continuity in a series of tales which otherwise are not too closely linked. To one who reads too literally, the implication that the dogs are a result of man's intervention may prove to be somewhat shocking. Rover, who has never seen in the legend anything beyond pure myth, thinks that here we are dealing with an ancient attempt to explain racial origins. To cover up actual lack of knowledge, the tale develops an explanation which amounts to divine intervention. It is an easy, and to the primitive mind, a plausible and satisfactory way to explain something of which nothing at all is known. Chapter 3. Census. Richard Grant was resting beside the little spring that gushed out of the hillside and tumbled in a flashing stream across the twisting trail when the squirrel rushed past him and shinnied up a towering hickory tree. Behind the squirrel, in a cyclone of churning autumn fallen leaves, came the little black dog. When he saw Grant, the dog skidded to a stop, stood watching him, tail wagging, eyes a dance with fun. Grant grinned. "Hello there," he said.
"Hi,"
said the dog. Grant jerked out of his easy slouch, jaw hanging limp. The dog laughed back at him, red dish rag of a tongue lolling from its mouth. Grant jerked a thumb at the hickory. "Your squirrel's up there."
"Thanks,"
said the dog.
"I know it. I can smell him."
Startled, Grant looked swiftly around, suspecting a practical joke. Ventriloquism, maybe. But there was no one in sight. The woods were empty except for himself and the dog, the gurgling spring, the squirrel chattering in the tree. The dog walked closer.
"My name," he said, "is Nathaniel."
The words were there. There was no doubt of it. Almost like human speech, except they were pronounced carefully, as one who was learning the language might pronounce them. And a brogue, an accent that could not be placed, a certain eccentricity of intonation.
"I live over the hill,"
declared Nathaniel,
"with the Websters."
He sat down, beat his tail upon the ground, scattering leaves. He looked extremely happy. Grant suddenly snapped his fingers.
"Bruce Webster! Now I know! Should have thought of it before. Glad to meet you, Nathaniel."
"Who are you?"
asked Nathaniel.
"Me? I'm Richard Grant, enumerator."
"What's an enumer...
"An enumerator is someone who counts people," Grant explained. "I'm taking a census."
"There are lots of words,"
said Nathaniel,
"that I can't say."
He got up, walked over to the spring, and lapped noisily. Finished, he plunked himself down beside the man.
"Want to shoot the squirrel?"
he said. "Want me to?"
"Sure thing,"
said Nathaniel. But the squirrel was gone. Together they circled the tree, searching its almost bare branches. There was no bushy tail sticking out from behind the bole, no beady eyes staring down at them. While they had talked, the squirrel had made his getaway. Nathaniel looked a bit crestfallen, but he made the best of it.
"Why don't you spend the night with us?"
he invited.
"Then, come morning, we could go hunting. Spend all day at it."
Grant chuckled. "I wouldn't want to trouble you. I am used to camping out." Nathaniel insisted.
"Bruce would be glad to see you, and Grandpa wouldn't mind. He don't know half what goes on anyway.
Who's Grandpa?
His real name is Thomas, said Nathaniel. But we all call him Grandpa. He is Bruce's father. Awful old now. Just sits all day and thinks about a thing that happened long ago.
Grant nodded. I know about that, Nathaniel. Juwayne.
Yeah, that's it,
agreed Nathaniel.
What does it mean?
Grant shook his head. Wish I could tell you, Nathaniel. Wish I knew. He hoisted the pack to his shoulder, stooped, and scratched the dog behind the ear. Nathaniel grimaced with delight.
Thanks,
he said, and started up the path. Grant followed. Thomas Webster sat in his wheelchair on the lawn and stared out across the evening hills. I'll be 86 tomorrow, he was thinking. 86. That's a hell of a long time for a man to live. Maybe too long, especially when he can't walk anymore and his eyes are going bad. Elsie will have a silly cake for me with lots of candles on it, and the robots all will bring me a gift, and those dogs of Bruce's will come in and wish me happy returns of the day and wag their tails at me. And there will be a few televisor calls, although not many, perhaps. And I'll pound my chest and say I'm going to live to be 100, and everyone will grin behind their hands and say, "Listen to the old fool." 86 years, and there were two things I meant to do. One of them I did, and the other one I didn't. A cawing crow skimmed over a distant ridge and slanted down into the valley shadow. From far away, down by the river, came the quacking of a flock of mallards. Soon the stars would be coming out. Came out early this time of year. He liked to look at them. The stars. He patted the arms of the chair with fierce pride. The stars, by Lord, were his meat. An obsession? Perhaps. But at least something to wipe out that stigma of long ago, a shield to keep the family from the gossip of historic busybodies. And Bruce was helping, too. Those dogs of his. A step sounded in the grass behind him.
Your whiskey, sir, said Jenkins.
Thomas Webster stared at the robot, took the glass off the tray. Thank you, Jenkins, he said. He twirled the glass between his fingers. How long, Jenkins, have you been lugging drinks to this family?
Your father, sir, said Jenkins.
And his father before him. Any news? Asked the old man. Jenkins shook his head.
No news.
Thomas Webster sipped the drink.
That means, then, that they're well beyond the solar system. Too far out even for the Pluto station to relay. Halfway or better to Alpha Centauri. If only I live long enough.
You will, sir.
Jenkins told him.
I feel it in my bones.
You, declared the old man, haven't any bones.
He sipped the drink slowly, tasting it with expert tongue. Watered too much again. But it wouldn't do to say anything. No use flying off the handle at Jenkins. That doctor, telling Jenkins to water it a bit more, depriving a man of proper drinking in his final years.
What's that down there?
He asked, pointing to the path that straggled up the hill. Jenkins turned to look.
It appears, sir, he said, that Nathaniel's bringing someone home.
The dogs had trooped in to say good night, had left again. Bruce Webster grinned after them.
Great gang, he said.
He turned to Grant.
I imagine Nathaniel gave you quite a start this afternoon.
Grant lifted the brandy glass, squinted through it at the light.
He did, he said.
just for a minute, and then I remembered things